Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory, men of his kingdom. One of the men who we are privileged to work with at the Center for Security Policy is a man who has been all about protecting our country from enemies, foreign and domestic, throughout his life of both service in the public policy arena and in the educational sphere. His name is Dr. Michael Waller. He has been very, very thoughtful, particularly on a problem that most of us are unaware even exists, and we wanted to visit with him at some length about it today. Political warfare is a term for it, and we're going to talk about its manifestations, both foreign and domestic. Mike Waller, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back to Securing America.
Hey, Frank. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Starting with the foreign piece of this, Mike, there have been a number of books and articles and other revelations and insights recently about what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing with something our friend Peter Schweitzer has called elite capture. I think that's actually the Chinese term for it, but he's popularized it in his new book, Red Handed. Talk a little bit about what this looks like and what it means. And I know you've been recently hearing from an influential legislator on this very subject, Senator Marco Rubio. Tell us about that.
Right, just a few minutes ago. Well, elite capture is literally the capturing of the opinions and then the controlling of the behavior and actions of elites in our society. So business elites, cultural elites, educational elites, political, legal, whatever other elites. It's capturing them and making them work in the service of the Chinese Communist Party.
And to the extent that this is done, what techniques are used to capture these elites, Mike? Is it just out and out graft and corruption? Is it political influence operations? Is it wining and dining? I mean, give us a sense of the comprehensiveness of not just the effort but the techniques applied.
Yeah, well, it can sound pretty mysterious, but really, it's all pretty basic. It's capturing human nature. So greed for money, greed for prestige, greed for influence and so forth, and making it so that those elites are dependent on the largesse of the Chinese Communist Party so those elites can then move ahead and in their fields or in their quarterly profit reports or their academic stature or their political stature. So it's everything from giving what in our society would be corrupt business deals. So it's not a free market arrangement in the sense of doing business in China. It's you're going in as a Chinese communist approved entity. There's an American person who might be running a large think tank in Washington or the China part of a large think tank or a large university in Boston, Massachusetts. And they're the gatekeepers. So they get a cut of the deals that are made, but they vet these American companies and elites to do business with the Chinese Communist Party and then give their stamp of approval to the party. That creates a dependency relationship where in order to maintain your business contacts in China, you have to do what the Chinese Communist Party wants. And that includes acting as an agent of influence to influence political leaders and journalists and so forth.
Mike, I want to come back to Marco Rubio in a moment, but just to stay with this thought, an interesting example of that sort of political influence and elite capture is particularly relevant to a fellow by the name of William Burns, who is now the CIA director. And Bill Burns previously was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and in that role had been responsible for enabling Chinese political influence operations, political warfare, by, you know, facilitating essentially the recruitment or otherwise the suborning of Americans through the prestige of the Carnegie Endowment and its collaboration with the Chinese operations. Marco Rubio asked him about that during his confirmation hearings, and he actually lied about the fact that he had terminated them when he had not. It's a prime example, it seems to me, and it's very worrying that the guy who's been compromised in that fashion is now the head of our CIA. But back to Marco Rubio's work at the moment trying to counter some of this, particularly with business elites. Mike, what is he trying to do, and how important do you think it is?
Well, a few minutes ago, he told us that he has 4 points in order to defend America against our greatest threat, which is not Putin's Russia, but actually communist China. One of those points was American businesses that are working as agents of the Chinese Communist Party here. He was naming them. He said Apple. He said Coca-Cola. He said Nike. And he mentioned Tesla and Disney. And that was a big one because Disney's his home state. It's one of the biggest employers in his home state of Florida. So he was very courageous coming out against these companies, saying how that they are arguably using slave labor because they're up in Xinjiang province, and they actively opposed his legislation to ban American companies from doing business with Chinese communist slave labor. So he called them out today and said, these guys are, they literally had the White House on the phone with Democratic senators to tell the Democratic senators to slow walk his legislation through the Senate.
Is he doing something about this other than exposing it at the moment, Mike?
Well, he's in the minority party, so there's only so much he can do. So he sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He gets all the briefings. He can release sanitized information in a safe manner, but he's really, really, really on top of this. So right now he's exposing it, and he's been forcing legislation through and using the Senate as a means of communicating with the public. But some of his legislation has become federal law, even though he's still in the minority. So he's doing the best any senator can.
Well, it's vital that he can continue, and I look forward to seeing what we can do to help support that work. Mike, let me ask you about Iran, another nation that has engaged in political warfare, I would argue, not least in terms of its humiliation of the United States in the course of this effort by the Biden administration to get a deal with the Iranians. How does this play into the larger enmity of the Iranian mullahs and their ambitions?
Well, Iran does things very differently from the way communist China does in terms of political warfare, which is sort of using the political and policy processes and systems to get its way. The way Iran is doing it is through a different type of elites, not so much American corporations, but through American diplomatic and academic and political elites, where we really don't know the nature of everything they're doing. We see the obvious co-optation there. So the mullahs have been working on this for years. They started out by humiliating President Jimmy Carter way back in the late 70s when they had the hostage crisis, and they saw that he was indeed a weak personality. They exploited that weakness. They humiliated us with that 444-day hostage crisis. But then the very hour that Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president of the United States, they freed the hostages, so they knew they couldn't continue to get away with that. What they're doing now is they're working through former Senator and Secretary of State John Kerry, who is now related by marriage to regime-affiliated people, and they've teamed up with certain conservatives or nominal conservatives, like Trita Parsi, at a new think tank in Washington.
Hold the thought, because I want to come back to Trita Parsi and the role that he's been playing in this, and also talk to you about Latin America and the extent to which we're seeing some of these foreign adversaries, including the Chinese and the Iranians, working against our vital interests there through, among other things, political warfare. We're going to have that conversation and more with Dr. Michael Waller right after this.
visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's hard to overstate the U.S. government's incoherence with respect to an extremely fraught topic. President Biden declared last week that Russian dictator Vladimir Putin, quote, cannot remain in power, unquote. The White House immediately claimed this was not a call for regime change, but yesterday, Mr. Biden insisted he wasn't backing away from his original comment, spinning it as moral outrage at Putin's bloodletting. Putin is reportedly relocated to one of his hardened underground leadership bunkers in the Ural Mountains. That may be due to paranoia about a coup d'etat. It's consistent, though, with preparation for a preemptive nuclear attack. Our presentdangerchina.org webinar last week made the case that given Russia's ability to launch such strikes essentially without warning, it behooves us to increase the readiness of our deterrent forces. Joe Biden's loose talk makes that not just prudent, but imperative. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we are continuing an important, very timely conversation with Dr. J. Michael Waller of the Center for Security Policy, or he is my colleague. Mike is a specialist in political warfare, and we're talking about how it manifests itself, both with enemies, foreign and domestic. Mike, you were just talking about Trita Parsi, a man that the regime in Tehran has described as an Iranian lobbyist, for heaven's sakes, but who managed nonetheless during both, I think, the Obama years and now under the Biden team to inveigle his way into influential operations inside of our government. Talk a little bit about how that is an example of this kind of political warfare that we're facing from that particular quarter.
Sure. Well, at first, it's important to, because for legal reasons, unless you can prove an agency relationship, it's very dangerous to allege one. So we're just talking about the allegations. Right. Well, what the Iranian regime has said. But when I say Trita Parsi is acting as an agent of the Iranian regime, I'm referring to alleged agent because he's all the indication is there. It's just a question of legally proving an agency relationship, which we haven't been able to do.
I think it's actually been demonstrated in federal court by somebody else who he accused of slander. But your point is well taken. This is a weapon that they use to try to silence
our legal
criticism.
System as what they call lawfare, a type of political warfare through our legal system to bog people down and to prevent them from being able to speak out. Anyway, so this guy, Parsi, who has been echoing all of the policy needs of the Iranian regime for years, has gone in with nominal conservatives in a Soros / Koch brothers funded Quincy Institute to be cloak himself as a moderate bipartisan expert on how best to make peace with the Iranian regime and stabilize the Middle East. So really, it seems to be an Iranian regime influence operation that's being waged right here in Washington. And the guy gets all kinds of media all the time, seldom being called out for being an alleged Iranian agent.
An insidious fifth column operation, to my way of thinking, and I appreciate your exposing it. Mike, very quickly, we also are witnessing the Iranians, including their sort of foreign legion, Hezbollah, operating in Latin America, along with the Chinese and Russians. A lot of that through the communists that have now taken over much of the continent and a sort of communist international, if you will, that has been operated, I guess, initially under the sponsorship of Lula, a man who may be shortly coming back to power in Brazil, heaven help us, called the Forum of São Paulo. Give us a sense of what that operation, among other external forces, are doing to Latin America, a region you're very familiar with.
Yeah, so we're dealing with now a new communist international in Latin America, based originally out of Cuba, backed by the Soviet Union, then after the Soviet collapse from Brazil, which had more cash than Cuba obviously had, run by this self-described Marxist, Lula da Silva, who became president of the country. It's called the Forum of São Paulo, and it integrates all the different Marxist, left-wing, and other communist parties in Latin America, as well as anybody else who's hostile to the United States and Western values, like communist China, like Hezbollah, the Shiite terrorists, like even Muslim Brotherhood, the Sunni jihadis, and so forth. And it integrates them into a movement where they support one another to exploit the democratic systems across Central and South America to communize all of them.
Achieve through political warfare, the takeover of these countries. Mike, this brings us quickly, and we won't have time to do full justice to it, but you have been very closely following political warfare on the domestic side as well. A prime example of it seems to me to be the January 6th events. You worked very closely with Tucker Carlson and others, including Senator Ron Johnson, to expose what seems to have been an incident of direct action against, the right in the Congress and problems that have flowed from it for not only the people who were up on Capitol Hill in that occasion, some of whom have been incarcerated for over a year now, in some cases in solitary confinement, for heaven's sakes, and an instrument, it would seem, of political warfare against the rest of us through intimidation, if nothing else. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a huge issue, and we still don't have a grasp on everything yet because there are so many different moving parts and new revelations. But what you had, what I saw at the time on January 6th was a pre-organized, pre-arranged, pre-set up political warfare operation to exploit a crowd of tens or hundreds of thousands of honest patriotic Americans and to attack the U.S. Capitol building, but make it look like it was a giant mob action. It was really an organized covert cadre. Right. Yes, as an insurrection, and then use that as an excuse to have these really draconian security measures across the country of really anybody who would be speaking out against government abuse of power. The really tough part of this is that when Senator Ted Cruz in January asked the FBI executive assistant director, number three in the FBI, responsible for national security, asked her a yes or no question. Were there any FBI agents or assets involved in the planning of the crimes of violence at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th? She didn't answer the question. She could have said yes. She could have said no. We were hoping she would say no, but instead she said she's not going to answer the question. He said, were there any FBI agents or assets present at the Capitol to commit crimes of violence? Again, she wouldn't say no. And then he said, were there any FBI agents or assets who committed crimes of violence at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th? And again, she didn't say no. So we can only conclude that they were there, and this is then now a form of our federal law enforcement running political warfare operations against the United States Congress, as well as against the U.S. public.
This is part of what has seemed to me to be a very, very worrying trend in the nature of weaponizing our security agencies against the American people. It's a terrifying development, needless to say. Let me just ask you about this commission that has been established, committee, I should say, in the Congress Select Committee to look into this affair. I dare say that line of questioning is not being asked of the FBI by the members of it. Instead, they seem to be, through subpoenas or invitations to appear, to be going after what are, frankly, the Democrats' political opponents. Talk a little bit about that as an example of political warfare and what it portends.
Well, the January 6th committee was so grotesquely set up that the Republican leadership in the House refused to have anything to do with it. And it wasn't to cover up anything. It was to simply say, this is all rigged as a dirt digging operation, and we're not going to have any part in it. So two liberal Republicans did take part in it. But really, if you look at what they're doing, is they are going on such it's like trawling for fish in the ocean. You're going to scoop up everything you can find. And now they're selectively leaking it to the press in order to attack the U.S. Supreme Court. You see the most recent things. You've got former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows dutifully turned over his text messages. And now they're using that to attack and to seek to impeach Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and they timed it while he was sick in the hospital. That's how grotesque this whole thing is. It's become an attack, not just on our on presidential political opponents, but on our very institutions.
And unfortunately, Mike, as you know, this conversation has demonstrated, it is part of a very pervasive, insidious, and unfortunately, to some extent at least, highly effective form of warfare against our country by enemies, domestic as well as foreign, through the vehicle of political warfare. Your expertise on these subjects, Mike, is, I think, unparalleled, and it's very valued by us here at Securing America. I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you often in the days ahead, because, frankly, we need to chronicle this, and we need to make sure that others understand exactly what's afoot and what it portends, as I say, for all of us. Thanks for the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Mike Waller, come back to us again soon, if you would. We'll be speaking next up with Peter Pry about the prospects of nuclear war, what we better be doing about it. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. And in understanding one of the most important threats we're facing at the moment, against which we must protect our country, I'm delighted to have back with us Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is a man with very extensive experience in our government, at the Central Intelligence Agency, where he was an analyst on Capitol Hill, where he was a professional staff member. He's been a staff member and a staff director of commissions created by the Congress, including on strategic forces, and also on the threat of electromagnetic pulse. He is a voluble contributor to the public policy debate, both in his periodical writings and his books, one of the most recent of which is Blackout Wars, also The Power and the Light. Peter is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, a valued member of our team, and we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him. Welcome back, Dr. Pry.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Peter, you contributed mightily to an important webinar that our Committee on the Present Danger China sponsored last week. People can check it out, and I hope they will, at presentdangerchina.org. Your piece of it in particular talked about the kinds of capabilities that the Russians have put into place at the moment, and the kinds of capabilities that we have been essentially preserving for decades without doing much to modernize. Let's start with the Russian order of battle at the moment, which is particularly important to understand as we are looking at a heightened alert status, we're told, by Vladimir Putin in the midst of this invasion of Ukraine. For starters, perhaps we could talk about the problem that most of these forces, it seems, are on a high level of readiness all the time and could, in fact, be utilized without warning.
Yes, that's right. The condition, their equivalent of DEFCON 5 is constant combat readiness, you know, where their forces are ready to launch in a few minutes. Most of Russia's strategic nuclear weapons are on intercontinental ballistic missiles, you know, which are over 95% ready to launch in a few minutes all the time. And so the thing that could put them at an higher readiness level and put us closer to nuclear war is the National Command Authority in the person of Vladimir Putin declaring you're going to a higher alert. There are things they can do that are largely invisible to us, like they stop communications exercises, they put on their earphones, and they wait to get emergency action messages. And so those forces
could, those would be launch orders.
Yes, that's right. Launch orders, the targeting information, which can all be done in about 3.5 minutes, invisible to us. So this idea that we don't see movements in their strategic posture that would indicate a heightened readiness is either a lie coming from the intelligence community or an attempt to cover up the fact that we are on the brink, that Biden's Ukraine policies have brought us to the brink. You know, even their ballistic missile submarines don't have to put to sea. Even they are armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles deliberately so that they can strike the United States from port. Their submarines that are at sea are usually in the bastion areas where they can be protected by the Navy, and they have command and control communications cables on the bottom of those bastion areas in the White Sea, the Sea of Okhotsk, where they can connect into that. And again, invisibly, without giving indicators to us, prepare for a surprise attack. And this would enable Russia to launch most of its nuclear weapons. The only part of their triad that's visible and noisy to us would be the bomber force. And that's the least unlike us, you know, where we put greater emphasis on bombers. You know, that is the least important part of their force. It has the fewest warheads, and they would probably deliberately not mobilize it so that we would misconstrue their readiness to launch a surprise attack.
Peter, this falls into the category of thinking about the unthinkable, a delusion that we've indulged in our country for decades, I think it's fair to say. The Russians have clearly, under Vladimir Putin, thought a lot about this, not only taking the preparations that you've talked about, but Putin himself has presided over, I have no idea how many, but quite a number of strategic exercises in which the Russians have simulated attacks by their own forces, to some extent in combination with Chinese forces, against the United States, using these kinds of nuclear capabilities you've just enumerated. Talk about what that suggests about Putin's attitude towards nuclear war fighting. Is it the case that he believes, as we've been told by successive American governments, that nuclear war cannot be won and certainly must never be fought?
Well, the Russians certainly don't believe that. Vladimir Putin clearly doesn't believe that because he's invested so much of Russia's scarce resources in building up not only the capabilities to offensively wage and win a nuclear war, but also to survive one. Now, unlike the United States, Russia has the most robust missile and bomber defenses in the world. They've got 10,000 SAMs and anti-ballistic missiles. They're dual-capable.
Surface-to-air missiles.
Yeah, they can carry nuclear and conventional warheads to stop our missiles and our bombers. They've got thousands of nuclear-hardened bunkers for civilian and military population, and uniquely have what the Pentagon calls deep underground shelters. That's their official name, that are hundreds of meters underground in solid granite inside of mountains. They are impervious to nuclear attack, and they are like small cities. They can accommodate just one of them, for example, can accommodate 30,000 military political leaders. And this is not just inherited from the Soviet era. Russia.
Peter, we're also told, by the way, that Vladimir Putin may be in one of those bunkers at the moment. Do you credit that report?
Yes, he and his general staff have largely disappeared from view. They're probably down in one of these bunkers. We don't know which one. There have been reports that elites have been flying out to the Urals, and they are probably in places like Yamantau Mountain, which is a city-sized underground facility. We don't know entirely its function, but it can accommodate a population the size of a small city. And then there's the Kavinsky Mountain General Staff Command Post, also in the Urals, that's impervious to nuclear attack, that is an enormous underground nuclear facility. So they are postured to fight and win a nuclear war. They're postured to strike first, to reduce as much as possible our retaliatory capabilities. And they could greatly reduce our retaliatory capabilities with a combination of EMP, cyber warfare, and direct kinetic attacks by nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Peter, I want to come back to that, but just one more question about this relocation to the Ural Mountains. I'm told that there have been large numbers of flights from Moscow to the mountains, and that families, as well as leadership figures, may have been dispatched out there as well. Again, how would this fit into a nuclear warfighting strategy if that's in fact what the Russians have in mind?
Yeah, if those reports are true, it indicates that we could be very close to the edge of a nuclear war. Because it means they're protecting their political and military elites, including their families, because they either intend to escalate or see the possibility of escalating by launching a first strike against us as an increasingly real possibility, a very real possibility, or they are misinterpreting some of the inappropriate language that President Biden has been using recently about regime change and about the United States jumping into the war in Ukraine, and in their paranoia, fear that the United States might try to beat them to the punch and launch a first strike, which they see as a real possibility. They believe they've had a long history of being surprised and attacked by their adversaries, and the possibility of miscalculation is at least equally grave as the possibility of a deliberate planned nuclear first strike from Russia.
Right. We're going to get into all of this in a moment after a short break, Peter. But before we get there, I just wanted to ask you very quickly, to the extent that we're talking about a doctrine of using nuclear forces, Putin, as I understand it, has called it escalate to de-escalate. Whether it's at the tactical level, in a place like Ukraine, perhaps, or whether it's at the strategic level, this seems to be enshrined now into the Russian war planning. Is that correct, as you see it?
Yes, that is correct. And they've played this many times under various scenarios. I would point out that the escalate to de-escalate scenario that most people are talking about, and in the West, I am pleased to see that more people are suddenly waking up. Even the woke are starting to waking up to the possibility of the use of tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And so they wanted to deter that. But under current conditions, that could be a more optimistic scenario if what we're being told is true, and I'm not sure it is, about the Russians losing the war in Ukraine, that they're doing so badly, that there's the threat of regime change from within, a revolution against Putin. If Russia's situation is really that desperate, as Theodore Roosevelt said, the only sin is soft hitting, it's less likely that their de-escalate to de-escalate strategy would involve tactical nuclear weapons, and it's more likely that they would go to the big show, to roll their...
Peter, I'm sorry to say we are out of time. There's so much more to talk with you about. I particularly appreciate the clarity that you bring to these issues of the planning, the capabilities, the intentions, as best we can divine them, of Vladimir Putin at a moment when an awful lot of loose talk is taking place about changing regimes or even the prospects of a tactical nuclear strike. These are the times that tried men's souls, as it's been said, and we'd best be alive to the distinct possibility that this particular enemy may well decide, if he is not properly deterred, to believe that it is possible to fight and win a nuclear war with the kind of capabilities he has. We'll be coming back to you, Peter, next week for much more on all of this. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Godspeed in your good work. Next up, we'll speak with Joseph Bosco right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. His name is Joseph Bosco. He has served in a number of capacities in the United States government over the years, including as the China Desk Officer in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, a position that is critical to our Defense Department's policy approach and programs vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party, our most mortal enemy. It's always good to have a chance to catch up with him, especially at a moment when, in the wake of the Ukraine invasion by Russia, the Chinese are clearly musing what to do about their territorial ambition, specifically vis-a-vis Taiwan. Joe Bosco has given a lot of thought to the topic. We're glad to have a chance to pick his brain. Welcome back, sir. It's good to have you with us at Securing America.
Thank you. Great to be back with you.
So I'd like to drill down on what you think Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, is making of what his partner, strategic ally, whatever you want to call him, Vladimir Putin, has done in Ukraine to this point, and whether it is causing some rethinking on Xi's part about his desire to use force. He's made no secret of that, against Taiwan for the purpose of attaching it firmly in with the mainland under China's dominion.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that, what was it, a month ago or 6 weeks ago, the Olympics in Beijing began, and Xi Jinping and Putin met and issued a 5,000-word statement of aligning their interests and their so-called values against the West. And it was a declaration of, I think they called it, a no-limits strategic partnership. Since then, of course, a few days later, Putin invaded Ukraine. The first question was, did Xi know that he was going to do that? Was that part of the planning? And if he did not know, has he been surprised and feel perhaps betrayed by Putin?
Well, and what's your answer to that question? Do you have any doubt that Xi and Putin talked about it?
I think that they did talk about it. And I think that he may not have said explicitly the date and when, how much he was going to invade, but it was there was no doubt that the military forces that he had assembled there were intended to make a move, unless he got the kind of concessions that he was demanding, which were non-negotiable from Ukraine's standpoint, that is, giving up any idea of getting into NATO and sacrificing its sovereignty. So I don't think she was surprised. What I think has surprised him is the unanimity of the West, of the rest of the world, against this move. And he's having second thoughts as to whether he got himself into a situation where China's reputation is being damaged by the things that Putin is doing.
And how would you characterize, Joe, what China is now doing with respect to Russia? There was talk early on that it was going to provide support. It was going to be buying Russian energy. It was otherwise going to try to fill in whatever punishment the sanctions were meting out. Has that happened, or has there been some of that, but some backing away from Russia as well?
Well, clearly it's not been very overt. It's not transparent, whatever they're doing. And I think we'll only discover that after the fact. But certainly, I don't think he wants to be quite open about supporting Putin. On the other hand, he hasn't condemned him either. He hasn't said this was a horrible thing to do and talk about human rights and all the rest. That's not his bag. So I think ultimately what China will, how this will affect their planning and their decisions is how the thing turns out in Ukraine. Keep in mind that in 2008, Putin invaded Georgia, didn't pay him an intolerable price for that. 2014, he invaded eastern Ukraine and took Crimea, hasn't paid an intolerable price for that. So in the long run, he's made steady progress. Now, China may well be thinking, why don't we do that, seize perhaps Komoi or some outside island of Taiwan's and take it step by step the way Putin has. It depends on how it turns out now, whether Putin has overplayed his hand.
Let me ask you about sort of two scenarios. One is, as you say, that they're watching and waiting. Xi, who's determined to get a third term, presumably a formality out of the People's Congress in the fall, but doesn't want to risk any mishaps there. Also facing some internal pressure, some opposition that seems to be inserting itself rather more aggressively these days. On the other hand, there are those who say, well, actually, for those reasons, assuming the cost to Putin is not excessively high, Xi may see this as an opportunity to engage in what tyrants often do in difficult circumstances, so-called social engineering, to try to get people to rally around the flag by getting into a scrape over Taiwan. What's your bookmaking at the moment, Joe Bosco, as to how this is likely to play out, assuming that the situation is more or less as it is now in Ukraine?
Well, as we know, Xi Jinping has even less concern for public opinion in China than Putin has in Russia. They've clamped down totally, and so he doesn't have to worry quite as much as about public revulsion at his association with Putin. But I think he won't, again, I don't think he'll make a move in the near future, but he may be contemplating what he's going to do some months down the road when the furor over Ukraine has subsided. But certainly he will do, as you say, stir nationalism. That's a given constantly in both China and Russia. Talk about the oppressive West and how it's interfering in their internal affairs and all the rest. But I don't think he'll make an overt move immediately, but he certainly is watching to see how he can play it over the long term. And I think he feels overall his hand has been strengthened. We haven't mentioned the unity of the West as much as we should.
Hold that thought, because we're going to come back to it on the other side of a very short break. Joe Bosco, we're going to also talk about what the United States should be doing under these circumstances to learn the lessons of Ukraine and deter the possibility of Xi making the calculation that he can, in fact, attack Taiwan with impunity, a calculation that his friend Vladimir Putin mistakenly made in Ukraine. That and more with Joe Bosco right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're visiting with Joseph Bosco, a former senior official in the Defense Department with responsibility for policy towards communist China. And Joe, you were talking about one of the things that has probably been impressed upon Xi rather dramatically in the aftermath of Xi Jinping's friend, Vladimir Putin, and his invasion of Ukraine, namely that the West has responded rather formidably in a unified manner, particularly imposing some rather draconian economic costs on Russia. So how is that factoring into the Xi's calculation, would you say? And to what extent do you think it's actually strengthened one of both his and Putin's agendas, which has been to break the dollar as the reserve currency of the world?
Well, there's no doubt that the West has been united on the economic front, the economic sanctions front. But I think we have to temper our enthusiasm there a bit, because in terms of the military situation within Ukraine and what the West has prepared to do about it, it's a sad picture. Whatever punishment Putin and his regime are taking in Russia, Ukraine's paying a heck of a price, and they are gradually losing sovereignty over certain parts of the country. Granted, there's some counteroffensives now. Let's hope they succeed. But overall, it's a sad plight when you think of the fact that 14 years ago in 2008, after around the time that they had invaded Georgia, the NATO and the United States pledged that Georgia and Ukraine would become members of NATO. 14 years have passed. We've slow walked that, and Putin has now seen his opportunity to take advantage of it. So militarily, if you analogize it to Taiwan, sure, the U.S. and the West can be expected to do all kinds of things economically against China if they move against Taiwan. But will we use force? That's still the question. Strategic ambiguity is still at play. We refuse to say we will defend Taiwan. That, in answer to your question, is the ultimate answer to deter China, to let them know that they will be incurring military force of the West if they attack Taiwan.
You've written frequently at The Hill about this topic, Joe, and I think have been very clear and persuasive, to my way of thinking at least, about the importance of moving past that strategic ambiguity, making, as you said just now, clear that we will defend them. Another takeaway, it seems to me, in terms of what U.S. policy should be at the moment from the Ukraine debacle is we should be providing the defensive equipment to Taiwan that it needs to defend itself now, not trying to figure out how to get it in there after an attack has begun. Would you agree with that? And if so, what kinds of capabilities do you think should be at the forefront in terms of such arming of Taiwan?
Well, you're certainly right that we should be doing that now, and we are doing it. I mean, we've been doing it for the last 20 years, but it's certainly significantly increased under the Trump administration. And fortunately, the Biden people have been following Trump's policies on getting closer to strategic clarity and defending and providing the defenses for Taiwan. There's a lot of things. I mean, there's the jet fighters. We haven't given them the most advanced systems available, even though we provide it to, say, Saudi Arabia and other places. We should be providing those kinds of things to Taiwan, as well as all the anti-air and anti-missile systems that we have available. We're still not providing to Ukraine the most sophisticated systems we have. And so China may be looking at that too and thinking, well, the U.S. may make a show of providing Taiwan with defenses, but in fact, they won't give them the most potent weapons they have. And that works to China's advantage in terms of its planning.
It does. Joe, this is taking place against the backdrop of some other steps. You mentioned the possibility that the Chinese might try to seize some islands off their coast that the Taiwanese are responsible for at the moment. But we've watched them moving inexorably elsewhere in the South China Sea. Notably, they've now apparently fully militarized some of the bastions that they've created out there, having promised not to do that. There's also now a very troubling deal, and we're going to be talking more about it in the days to come, I think, with respect to the Solomon Islands, a place where an awful lot of American blood was spilled in World War II to wrest those from the Japanese, strategic islands. Talk a little bit about what the Chinese are doing with this, well, to coin a phrase, Highland hopping exercise in the Pacific and its implications for Taiwan and our interests in the region.
Yeah, they're being very clever strategically. They're not focusing only on Taiwan. They see the entire Indo-Pacific as their home domain, and they will counter U.S. moves wherever they can. And the Solomons have presented a new opportunity, the whole Belt and Road Initiative, where they get economic inroads into these places and provide resources for the countries that do recognize Taiwan to change their recognition. It's a multi-dimensional, multifaceted approach. It's military, it's economic, it's diplomatic, political. So they're playing every card they can in every place they can, in every region of the world, South America, Europe, the Indo-Pacific, obviously. So it's a comprehensive strategy. They think over years and decades. We tend to think in much shorter terms. And the strategy has worked now for Russia and Ukraine to a certain extent. And China will probably follow the same pattern as it has in the past and in the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah. Joe, this point about the Belt and Road Initiative and its strategic purposes is so important. I'd like to get you back to talk about that at greater length, because I think, as you say, the sheer comprehensiveness of it is staggering. As I recall, we did a study of this, our Committee on the Present Danger China, last summer. 145 countries or so out of 190 are now part of that, industrial-grade infrastructure build-out colonial empire, if you will, in the making. And it's of huge strategic significance, not just in, of course, the Western Pacific, but worldwide. We'll be back to talk with you about that in the near future. Thank you, sir. And thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to do that, and that you'll join us at securingamerica.tv to learn more about what and how you can help protect the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And then I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.